on WNYC. Now Princeton historian Gary Bass, who has a new book that takes a closer look than others have taken at Richard Nixon's and Henry Kissinger's role in a genocide, he uses that word, involving Pakistan and Bangladesh in the 1970s and the relevance for protecting human rights today. The book is called The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. Gary Bass is a Princeton poli-sci and international affairs professor whose other books that you may know include Freedom's Battle, The Origins of Humanitarian Intervention, and Hand of Vengeance, The Politics of War Crimes Tribunals. And we'll touch briefly on those topics, too, since they're so relevant to what's happening in Syria and at the UN and elsewhere. Professor Bass, thanks very much for coming on today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Genocide is a strong word. What was this forgotten genocide?
It's a series of mass killings in present-day Bangladesh, but what was in 1971 when these forgotten events were happening, what was the eastern part of a unified country of Pakistan. And it's a series of terrible atrocities. The CIA, midway through the killing, privately, conservatively estimates that 200,000 people have been killed by the Pakistan military against its Bengali population.
Are you charging that the Nixon administration somehow enabled this?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it's a very unhappy story, but that's absolutely the picture that emerges from newly declassified documents and from the White House tapes that the Nixon administration knew in great detail about what was happening. Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger were very well informed about what was going on. They made statements indicating that they understood what was going on. And it's not just that they stood by. The United States in this period was an ally of Pakistan and stood behind the Pakistan army and the military authorities as these terrible killings were happening.
You write of major consequences beyond the genocide itself, including a war between Pakistan and India. What's the connection?
Well, there's this huge killing campaign has a spillover effect. India is next door. And something on the order of 10 million Bengali refugees flee from East Pakistan, present-day Bangladesh, flee into India. So it's one of the biggest refugee flows in human history. And they're fleeing into a very unstable part of India at the best of times. And then you add 10 million refugees on top of that, and it's a recipe for tremendous instability. So the Indian government find a solution to have these refugees find a safe way to be able to go home. And also, I mean, obviously, the Indian government is more than happy to have a chance to try and rip apart Pakistan, its hated rival. So in December of 1971, there's a huge full-scale war between India and Pakistan that ends that's over within 14 days and ends with the creation in December 1971 of this new country of Bangladesh.
You have quotes of Nixon and Kissinger from the time that you call their fog of self-justification that seem to link their actions on India and Pakistan, or maybe inaction, to Nixon's historic opening to China. What's the connection?
Well, so the killing campaign starts in March of 1971, and Kissinger's first secret trip where he sneaks into Beijing is in July of 1971. So Nixon and Kissinger are keeping an eye on their secret channel to China, and that's being done. They try a couple of different back channels to reach out to the Chinese that the U.S. government hasn't been dealing in a normal way with communist China. And one of the channels, the one that ultimately is the most successful channel, is through Pakistan, through the military dictator of Pakistan, who's very helpful in carrying messages back and forth. And I think, it's appropriate, Nixon and Kissinger's legacy, their foreign policy legacy, the most important thing for them is the opening to China. And I think it's important, to remember that, but also to remember the terrible cost that's paid for it by Indians and by Bengalis.
Are the events you write about in this book still shaping Asia today or affecting the United States?
Well, Bangladesh, which I think, you know, Nixon and Kissinger always spoke about it with contempt. Kissinger notoriously refers to it as a basket case. And I think for a lot of Americans, it's seen as a country that, you know, is not particularly well understood. This is the eighth largest country in the world. This is a country that has a population that's bigger than Russia and bigger than China. Not bigger than China, bigger than Japan. Sorry, that came out horribly wrong. So, you have this country for whom 1971 remains the founding trauma. There's a series of war crimes trials that are going on to this day, which are the cause of demonstrations and counter-demonstrations. So it does have an ongoing legacy. And, you know, the reputation of the United States in India is still stained by this memory of the way in which the Nixon administration so vigorously supported Pakistan in 1971.
Gary Bass, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. And let me turn briefly to the subjects of your other books, Humanitarian Interventions and War Crimes Tribunals. The U.S. and Russia, as I'm sure you know, did manage to agree yesterday on a Syria chemical weapons surrender resolution. Are you confident that this will work and remove the possibility of a military intervention threat by the United States? Do you have a view on this?
Well, I don't think anybody's particularly confident that it'll work. I think it's definitely worth exploring, and, you know, I hope that it does. The resolution mentions the possibility of Chapter 7 sanctions, which means, you know, the possibility of military force. That's the way that, you know, in the language of the UN Charter. So it's still on the table. It seems as though the Obama administration is obviously quite reluctant to do that, which makes it harder, I think, for the Syrians to believe that it's a really credible threat. But I do think it's important that you have Russia standing behind this process, which means that if the process fails, if the process becomes a joke, then Russia has guaranteed it. Russia really is under some obligation to stand behind it.
If the U.S. had intervened militarily in Syria over the chemical weapons, or if it still does, would that fit your definition of a humanitarian intervention?
It might. I mean, I do think that an intervention just over chemical weapons might be, you know, you could equally well see that as upholding part of a long-standing tradition in international law and in, you know, in the way we think about justice during war, that says that certain kinds of weapons are just too cruel to be used in war, including poisons. So chemical weapons are something that for a long time have been seen as something really outlawed. The question of whether or not that would, you know, people would see it as a humanitarian intervention, I think there would be some people who would and others who would say, look, why is it that we're so focused on these weapons, on the killing with chemical weapons, as opposed to, you know, a very long campaign of killing being done with conventional weapons? Aren't those killings bad too? I do think there's a special status to chemical weapons, but that's the argument that you'll hear.
We had historian Andrew Bacevich on the show earlier in the week, 23-year Army veteran, big critic of U.S. Foreign policy, arguing against most U.S. humanitarian interventions because they usually involve remaking societies, which we can't actually succeed at. How close are you to that view?
I have tremendous respect for Bacevich, for his service, and I think, you know, his criticisms of American foreign policy are important, and you need to hear those views. I reviewed one of his books in the New York Times Book Review, and I thought it was excellent. I disagree with that. I think that the United States has sometimes been extremely successful in reshaping societies. If you look at Germany and Japan after World War II, those are two of the biggest political success stories of the 20th century, is changing, you know, fascist totalitarian regimes into peace-loving democracies. That's an extraordinary success. And Bosnia also is something that I think, is a success story, where it's not a perfectly functioning state by any means, but compared to where it was, where it had a vicious 3.5-year civil war and an international war from 1992 to 1995, And now the place, you know, it's not the best functioning country in the world, but it's extraordinary how much progress it's made thanks to a NATO intervention there.
Also regarding Syria, an alternative to military intervention that several people raised on this show was bringing Assad before a war crimes tribunal, a legal process in place of a military process. As somebody who's written a book on war crimes tribunals, do you think that could have worked, or that a war crimes tribunal could still be pursued because of the chemical weapons attack?
It could be. It's difficult. And I do, you know, I think of you, essentially what you want is sort of to have a wide range of human rights policy instruments that you can try and use. And that would include everything from the most radical, the most extreme step of military intervention, which, as you know, we've seen in Iraq and Vietnam and Afghanistan, is something that can go horribly wrong. But then you would have a bunch of other, you know, diplomatic steps, including economic sanctions, including the use of various UN human rights instruments, and including war crimes tribunals. So one possibility would be to try and go after Bashar al-Assad with this court that exists in The Hague called the International Criminal Court. The tricky part under international law is that to go after Syria through this court, because Syria is not going to agree to the jurisdiction of this war crimes tribunal for obvious reasons, the only way that you can do it in international law is for the UN Security Council to pass a Chapter 7 resolution referring the Syrian case to the International Criminal Court, and then you just run into the familiar logjam of what are the Russians and the Chinese going to do.
By the way, why is your book on tribunals called Hand of Vengeance rather than Hand of Justice?
It's a quote. The title is a quote from the U.S. chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, who has in his phenomenal sort of Shakespearean opening statement at Nuremberg, says that four great nations flushed with victory and stung with injury stay the hand of vengeance and submit their captive enemies to the judgment of the law is one of the most significant tributes that power has ever paid to reason. So it's stay the hand of vengeance.
Do you think war crimes tribunals, as they become more frequent, I think we've seen some historic steps forward on that with respect to heads of state and the atrocities that they've committed. Do you think it can reduce the amount of war in the world?
I think it's possible. The original plan, you know, the objective at Nuremberg is to outlaw aggressive war. And that's something where I think we haven't seen that much success, that war crimes tribunals have been less about preventing wars from happening in the first place and more about imposing limits on the cruelties that happen in the way that they're fought. And you have seen, you know, Slobodan Milosevic wound up on trial. Charles Taylor, an appeals court by something called the Special Court for Sierra Leone, just handed down a verdict where they denied his appeal, so he's got a 50-year jail term for atrocities. Heads of state, I think, just, you know, once upon a time, never imagined that they would wind up sitting inside of a court. And now it's a real possibility. These things do happen. If you were Omar al-Bashir, how confident could you really be that you're not going to one day wind up facing justice for your atrocities?
Princeton historian Gary Bass, his new book is The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, wait, it's Mo Rocca. He'll be here to talk about Cooking with Grandmothers, the second season of his show. We'll take your phone calls. We'll take phone calls from grandmothers, grandfathers, grandchildren. And Mo Rocca, stay with us.